listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
In the aftermath of President Trump's announcement that the U.S. would withdraw from the JCPOA with Iran, we take a look at how the withdrawal by the U.S. is being viewed in Tehran by Iranians. We bring you this edition of the program The Debate from Iran's press agency Press TV, hosted by Iranian journalist Kovi Tavway.
Hello and welcome to The Debate. I'm Kovi Tavway. The U.S. has exited the JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran, and with that, the U.S. credibility, well, in many respects, has gone out of the door. Iran's leader has slammed the U.S. president's decision and threats, along with the other signatories of the deal, like France, Germany, and the U.K. Now, in this debate, we're going to take a look at the fallout from the U.S. withdrawal, how it will affect the U.S. standing in the world, and what kind of steps Iran will take, like whether or not to stay in the deal. From Vienna first, let's talk to our correspondent, Homa Lesky, who joins us. Well, today was an important day, the day after the U.S. to pull out from this historic deal, Homa. Tell us what the IAEA has said regarding the way that Iran has adhered once again to its commitments when it comes to the IAEA and its provisions.
Yes, Pablo. Well, I think the statement that came out of the International Atomic Energy Agency is important because it echoes the stance that we've been seeing from the European partners to this deal, because Mr. Amano, who's head of the agency, says in that statement that he believes the JCPOA provides a strong verification system, is in fact the most robust verification system in the world for Iran, and he said this before, that he believes a collapse of the JCPOA would be a loss in terms of verification as well as for multilateralism. Now, the sense that we're getting from Europe as of now is that they're going to stick to the deal, and from what I'm hearing, at least the European sense that we're seeing here in Vienna, and the stance that a lot of critics have taken, is that what President Trump did shows that for him, the opinions of the Europeans is not important, and he doesn't care about what they believe is the right decision. He wants to go his own way, but it remains to be seen what step Europe will take. I mean, critics here in Europe and observers are saying that the level and amount of economic relations between Europe and the United States is much more than Europe's relations in terms of economy with Iran. So will Europe actually stick to the deal and risk this tension in relations with the United States? What cost would it have? This remains to be seen. As of now, both Iran has said that as long as its interests are being satisfied, is going to stick to the deal. And the Europeans, Ms. Mogherini, as well as the three other European countries have said that they want the deal to be in place as well. But the International Atomic Energy Agency statements that I just conclude here again says that it's verifying that Iran has stuck to its side of the bargain, is implementing fully its commitments underlined under the JCPOA. And another important aspect, I think, of Ms. Amono's comments, I'll just conclude here, is also the fact that the inspections that have been taking place in Iran since the implementation of the deal more than 2 years ago, and even since 2013, the IAEA says these inspections have doubled. These inspections, Mr. Amono says, have been the most robust and at the highest level that has ever happened in the world. And this, he says, is a significant gain for the international community. And in Iran's words, also shows Iran's confidence building, if we could phrase it like that. If the deal collapses, this system would also collapse.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. Homa Leski, our correspondent, talking to us from Vienna. Let me introduce our guests for this edition of the debate. We have from the Security Studies Program at MIT, Jim Walsh, who joins us from Boston, and also from San Francisco, from the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker joins us. Gentlemen, welcome. Jim Walsh, I'm going to start with you to follow up on what our correspondent there from Vienna said, and just on a technical standpoint, you know, the IAEA making its statement, and you as a security studies program from MIT looking at this, don't you think that then a conclusion would be that it was a mistake what Trump did, risking Iran perhaps pulling out of the deal altogether?
Yeah, I do think it was a mistake, but I'm not alone in that view. I mean, basically, Mr. Trump's previous national security advisor, his secretary of defense, his secretary of state, his new secretary of state, the Republican House chair of the House Defense Committee, they all said don't pull out, as well as all the U.S. allies, and he did it anyway. So there are a lot. He received lots of advice telling him not to do it, and he chose to ignore all that advice.
Okay, let's go on now to Richard Becker. Richard Becker, there's so much criticism against this U.S. decision, and the Europeans now steadfast, especially in the way that the EU foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini came out last night and saying we are going to stick to the deal, and the U.K. has said the same, France has said the same, but the big question is, in their scramble to save the Iran deal, how are they going to be able to do that?
Well, that certainly is a question. I would make the point, first of all, that while the Trump administration and previous U.S. administrations have always invoked the quote-unquote international community when they were targeting some particular country, now they're not talking about the international community because aside from Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Israel, and the United States, no one has spoken in support of the withdrawal from this agreement. But I think that we have to keep in mind that the Trump administration and its closest advisors, like John Bolton, have a very definite objective in mind, and it's not just really ending this agreement. What they're going for is regime change. Just a week ago that John Bolton said that that is the strategy, that is the goal, is regime change. He affirmed that again, and so did Rudolph Giuliani. And so you have the U.S. pulling out of the agreement, but I think that's part of a larger strategy that they hope that will create disappointment and discontent within Iran, particularly because many people in Iran were very hopeful in 2015, that the end of sanctions, if they were to really end, would mean a relief for Iran and for the Iranian economy, which had suffered greatly under the sanctions, which were engineered not by the Republicans, but in fact by Hillary Clinton back in 2010 when she was the Secretary of State.
Okay, I'm looking at the transcript here, Jim Walsh, of what the U.S. president said last night. And it was interesting how he says at the, towards the end that, he's going to be there if the European allies and the other signatories are able to come up with an agreement or a deal that Iran is going to comply with to satisfy the expectations that the U.S. has. That kind of doesn't go with what our guest there said in terms of the higher aspirations, if I understood him correctly, of regime change. Or is that just a prelude for now that he's saying to keep Iran intact with this deal, given the new arrangements, if Iran even goes for it?
Well, I don't think he has a strategic view of this at all. I mean, you're right to point out the tension on the one hand saying, we want a new agreement, which he did say. And by the way, when he started to ad lib, he said, well, the Iranians aren't going to want to negotiate after I've done this. And I don't blame them. I'd feel the same way. And then in the very next sentence says, but they'll have to have an agreement. And I do agree that some elements within the Trump administration have been advocates of regime change, Mr. Bolton in particular. But the president has never shown much fondness for that sort of thing. He criticized the war in Iraq. And certainly the Department of Defense has no interest in regime change. They will certainly counsel against that. But I agree that there's a basic contradiction here. And my sense of it is, again, there's not a lot of strategy. He was just determined to do this. And you'll remember that Boris Johnson, the foreign secretary for Britain, said in an interview the previous day that Plan B didn't seem very well developed, using a classic sense of British understatement. And that became apparent. He hasn't thought about what they're going to do next. There is no Plan B. There is no follow-on strategy. He just sort of blurted it out there. And now we're just going to see what happens.
Well, Richard Becker, going by what you said, Trump has come out with a couple statements today, of which some of the highlights were, one, Iran better not resume its nuclear program, or else that type of sentiment relayed in one of his statements, and another one stating that Iran better come and negotiate. Kind of goes against what he said in terms of pulling out of the deal. What messages does that send? Or off the cuff making some statements and waiting for reactions?
Well, I think that what we see there is this kind of towering colonialist rhetoric coming from Trump, and he certainly has that in unbelievable quantities within him. He speaks as an imperialist. I mean, and he feels that he can tell the world, the rest of the world, what to do. The problem, I think, a fundamental problem here, is that the other parties to the agreement, to the JCPOA, may want to continue with it, and they do want to continue with it. They've made that clear. The problem that they will face, though, is if Trump implements the highest level of sanctions, as he promised in his speech, then they will end up, their corporations and banks will end up being confronted with a choice, and that is, do you want to trade with Iran or do you want to trade with the United States? So I think that's the real, a great problem. If it was not for the extraterritoriality of the sanctions regime, that would not be so much of a problem for the other big powers. But the sanctions have always been implemented with that extraterritoriality factor, meaning that the U.S. isn't just saying, we're not going to trade or not allow corporations and banks to trade, U.S. corporations and banks to trade with Iran, but we're going to inflict pain in the form of billions and billions of dollars in fines on other banks and corporations from other countries if they choose to continue to do business with Iran and violate, quote unquote, violate the U.S. sanctions.
Very good. We've reached the halfway point here. Let's take a quick time out, listen to some of the viewer comments on this, which there have been so many, and then we'll get right back to the debate.
Trump has made the U.S. isolated by the international community for the second time since the Jerusalem embassy move. Trump has withdrawn the United States from the civilized world. Who will want to make any deals with the U.S. in future? Symptoms of totalitarianism and a one-world order overriding the will of the citizens of the world. Iran should continue its nuclear program as soon as possible and as much as possible. Unfortunately, it sounds like the Trump administration is already threatening to impose sanctions on European companies that continue to do business with Iran. The deal has yet to deliver something to Iran more than cosmetic shopping. In my opinion, the West has got more from the deal than the Iranians, and yet it's them who leave the deal or ask for renegotiation.
Okay, some of the viewer comments there. During this break, Jim Walsh, I was thinking about how obviously these the Europeans, along with Russia and China, if they are true to their word, first of all, to go out on a limb and try to, come up with this agreement and at the same time not pull out of the deal. Do you think that in the short term, perhaps things may somewhat pay off, but then it's going to taper off based on, for example, sanctions that the U.S. may impose on them? Because the sanctions obviously is not something that the Europeans or any other countries of these signatories want to suffer from. But at the same time, doesn't that mean that the U.S. risks alienating itself even further? Because you have a U.S. president who has broken trade agreements like the climate change and other trade agreements. We could talk about NAFTA that has been broken yet all the way, et cetera.
Yeah, I'd say first we're in uncharted waters here, so it's hard to know what's going to happen next. I would say secondly, what complicates this is that the sanctions are not aimed at governments, and the promises or hope in the Iran agreement in terms of sanctions relief for Iran, the main actor there are not government actors, right? It's private industry. So the governments, if it was just the governments that were involved, well, France or China or Russia could say with authority, well, the French government or the Russian government is going to continue to sign deals with Iran. But we're not talking about governments. We're talking about private businesses. And so the French and the British and the Chinese can't force their companies, private entities, to invest in Iran if those private entities don't want to take the risk. And some of them are not going to want to take the risk. Now, I think the Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese can do things to protect their companies from sanctions, to shield them from sanctions. But I think these are mostly going to be partial solutions. And really, the big political question here that you raise is, when are the Europeans going to say enough is enough? And, you know, we might be at that point. I don't know. It might be something else that is the straw that breaks the camel's back, because we've had the president withdraw from the climate change accord. He withdrew from the trade agreement, and now he's withdrawn or violated, I should say, not withdrawn. He's violated the UN Security Council resolution establishing the Iran nuclear agreement. And at some point, the Europeans may just say, to hell with this, this guy is just too much trouble, and try to do something on their own. But that would be a big step. That would be big. I don't know if we're there yet. And so what we are right now is sort of in the messy middle.
Well, let's look at what has happened there, Richard Becker. First of all, you have the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's over in Russia. Second of all, you've had the U.S. Come out and make a statement based on some of the news that it is going to convince its European partners not to save this deal. Again, that's a contradictory message compared to what the Trump said the night before in his statements. But it seems like they're heading towards the way that they want to just have all the signatories not comply with this. Two of the big ones, Russia and China. Do you think that the U.S. is going to have some kind of communication with those concessions that are going to be made at Iran's expense?
I think it's very possible. I think it's worth reflecting on when the sanctions, the UN sanctions, Security Council sanctions, came into being in 2010 and 2011. In her memoir, Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State, who was an avid seeker of the harshest sanctions possible against Iran, the State Department directed all of its embassies in the world to find out what companies in their country, the country they were posted to, were trading with Iran. The same thing goes for Cuba. The same thing's been going on for Cuba for 50 years, that every embassy has a person who's designated to look out for any trade with Cuba. And in regard to the trade with Iran, if that policy, if the sanctions now are inflicted on Iran in the same kind of way, where a worldwide effort is carried out to destroy the Iranian economy, because that would be the objective. I don't think they can completely succeed in that, but that's what the objective is: economic destruction, inflict as much suffering as possible, and then, you know, this age-old hope that that will cause the people to rise up because they're suffering, and that would bring about would be the key element in bringing about regime change. That's what I think we have to see as a very real possibility of what's coming. And I think that, as your other guest mentioned, there is a question: will the other NATO allies and Russia and China go along with that, or is this a moment when the world situation begins to change and the distribution of power, the overweening power of the United States, is seriously challenged?
Well, I'd like to ask you, Jim Walsh, one of the first statements coming out of... First of all, do you have a reaction? I see the look on your face. I think you have something you'd like to say. I'm sorry.
I have real skepticism about what we just heard. I don't think the Europeans are going to join some regime change strategy and impose draconian sanctions on Iran. I think the stuff about Hillary Clinton is completely irrelevant.
I didn't say that.
I think if Hillary Clinton were president, there's no way... just let me finish, please. I listened to you for a long time. I don't think Hillary Clinton's really relevant. If she had been president, no way she rips up the agreement. As much of a hawk as she might be, she would not have ripped up this agreement. This is about Trump. It's not about some giant systemic, you know, ideological thing. This is about this particular guy who is an outlier in almost every part of life. I mean, no one behaves the way he behaves. All the advice he got from his own advisors, maybe other than Bolton, but from his own department heads, was don't do this, and he did it anyway. So I think this is much more Trump specific, and if we had had almost any other president from any party, we wouldn't be doing this right now.
Okay, Richard Becker, and by the way, Jim Walsh, before I let you go and go to Richard Becker, hold on a second. Jim Walsh, do you believe what John Bolton said? He said that Trump didn't know whether he was going to pull out or not until the press conference?
I think that's entirely possible. I mean, I think he was planning to do it, but this is a president who changes his mind. Even after he announces things, he changes his mind. I think he's very mercurial. He's a very hard person to predict because he's basically a bag of emotions.
Okay. So, Richard Becker, I mentioned about Netanyahu being in Russia. One of the first things now that has come out from his visit there that he has said is that Netanyahu said that Russia understands why we have interest in Syria in terms of how they're conducting themselves. That may provide a clue as to the way Russia perhaps is going to be handling maybe Iran. I'm guessing. I'm wondering what you think, because Russia has been pretty quiet when it comes to Israel conducting airstrikes within Syria. And of course, we've seen recently that it's in areas where you have the Iranian military advisors present.
Well, first of all, just let me say, I wasn't saying that the European governments were going to try to bring about regime change. I don't know where your other guest got that from. My point was that what the U.S. strategy of sanctions is intended to do is to create discontent inside Iran, and that would bring about regime change. And the relevance of Hillary Clinton is that when she carried out the sanctions, the inflicting of sanctions in 2010, her State Department, the same thing would be repeated. I'm not saying Hillary Clinton's going to do it because she's out of office, but the same kind of exhaustive attempt to break down trade relations, to destroy the Iranian economy would be, I think that's what's coming again. As far as Russia and Syria and Israel, this, you can see the danger that the Israeli attacks inside Syria. I think that the Israeli government is looking for a response from Iran to launch a bigger attack, perhaps on Iran itself. And I think that the Russians are very aware of this, and I think everyone is pretty aware that the provocations being carried out by the State of Israel are extremely dangerous and can lead, even if none of the parties are hoping for it, to a much wider war. So I think Russia, up until this point, has refrained from strongly responding to it. But, you know, it's a very dangerous situation.
We continue our coverage of the U.S. abrogation of the JCPOA with Iran, as announced earlier this week by President Donald Trump, with this from RT's Caleb Maupin.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
The agreement meant to restrict Iran's nuclear energy program, the crowning achievement of the Obama White House, has finally been terminated by the Donald.
Today's action sends a critical message. The United States no longer makes empty threats. When I make promises, I keep them.
But how much impact is this really having? Only one country, the United States, is withdrawing. And Iran doesn't seem particularly worried.
I have ordered the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to negotiate with and lobby the European countries, as well as Russia and China, and to carry out the necessary coordination with them.
Russia and China are ready to keep things going as is. So are key allies of the United States and the European Union.
The European Union is determined to preserve it. We expect the rest of the international community to continue to do its part to guarantee that it continues to be fully implemented for the sake of our own collective security. Together with the rest of the international community, we will preserve this nuclear deal.
Under the current circumstances, we call on all parties concerned to adopt a responsible attitude. China will maintain close communication with all relevant parties and stay committed to upholding and implementing the deal in an objective, impartial, and responsible way.
We're deeply concerned over the U.S. President's decision to unilaterally abandon its obligations under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action on the Iranian nuclear program and reimpose sanctions on Iran.
Now, this isn't the only global decision the Trump administration has made to be met with chirping crickets. Remember when the USA moved its embassy to Jerusalem? Other than Paraguay and Guatemala, the rest of the world was not exactly clamoring to follow suit. And remember when Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Change Accords? Well, the other 195 countries that have signed on, they frowned at Washington for a minute, and then they moved on as if nothing had happened. The accords remain exactly the same. So, once again, we've got a big drum roll and fanfare from the White House. But with the rest of the world refusing to go along, is Washington's global leadership really all it's cracked up to be?
Let's be very clear about that. Mr. Trump did not simply exit the JCPOA. He violated the U.S.'s written obligations under the term. And that is a very delicate, important point that has been raised by Mogherini and others. And this might go to, the International Court of Justice and, other legal forums, the UN Security Council.
That was RT's Caleb Maupin reporting from New York. Meanwhile, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in Moscow on Wednesday for the celebration of the end of World War II. RT's Neil Harvey filed this report.
Well, besides Trump, one of those most in favor of scrapping the nuclear agreement has been the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as we heard earlier, is currently in Moscow. He recently gave a rather theatrical PowerPoint presentation that decried the deal. Netanyahu has praised the U.S. president's decision.
Israel has opposed the nuclear deal from the start because we said that rather than blocking Iran's path to a bomb, the deal actually paves Iran's path to an entire arsenal of nuclear bombs.
Israeli influence is absolutely key here. Trump cited Netanyahu's
kind of used car salesman style presentation in order to justify withdrawing from the Iran deal and his new policy of rollback. And, you know, first of all, we have to recognize Netanyahu introduced nothing new in his presentation. The intelligence was arguably fabricated that Netanyahu had introduced that Trump cited. It's another intelligence scam driving us to war.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Armenia's parliament elected protest leader Nikol Pashinyan as prime minister on Tuesday after weeks of peaceful and unusually joyous protests. Having danced their way to the most dramatic power transition in the country's modern history, what will it take for Armenia's new leadership to give its people what they are asking for? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Babken Dergrigoryan, international media liaison for Nikol Pashinyan's transition team. Babken, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being here with us. I understand it's been a very, very long and joyous day for you. So thank you again for joining us and congratulations.
Thank you for having me and thank you.
Now, Mr. Pashinyan managed to get the support of about half the parliament. 59 out of 105 members of parliament supported him. And that vote comes on the heels of another vote barely a week ago when the majority of lawmakers rejected his candidacy. What has happened in those few days to alter the mood in parliament so much?
Well, I think what's happened specifically is that the Republican Party has had to come to with the mood of the country and the public opinion, and they basically had no choice but to vote in Nikol Pashinyan as the next prime minister of Armenia.
Now, when the news of Pashinyan's election or selection rather broke, his supporters took to the streets, many of them wearing white clothes, which I understand were a symbol of their hopes for the country. What is your understanding of what people expect from the new leadership?
Well, I think what most people expect from the new leadership is exactly what Nikol Pashinyan has been talking about throughout this campaign, which is that the new government will be based on transparency, on legitimacy. It will be founded on legitimacy by the people. It will be based on transparency and justice. And I think that's what the people expect. And I'm pretty sure that that is what Nikol Pashinyan will be delivering.
Now, I've heard many Armenians say that what they hope for is an economic and political system serving and benefiting the people rather than clans. And I think this is something that we can all relate to, but it's easier said than done because Armenia is a very close-knit society with strong family connections with many informal institutions. Do you think that's going to present a problem while trying to rid the system of the clan influence?
Well, I don't think the main problem in Armenia is clans or family ties. I think the main problem in Armenia has been the oligarchic system. And Pashinyan has very specifically said that oligarchs will not be part of his government and that there will be a level playing field for all businesses. And I think that's what people expect.
Mm-hmm. Well, a number of former Soviet republics, Russia, Ukraine, Georgia, to some extent, even Uzbekistan, have attempted to limit the influence of big businesses or big families, important families, on power with, let's say, very varying degrees of success. Generally speaking, it's very difficult because powerful and rich people do not like to lose their privileges. What makes you believe that Armenia will find it easier?
Well, I think, first of all, it's the general mood of this revolution. It was one based on solidarity and love throughout society, first of all. Second of all, I think even the big businesses realize that for the basic sustainability of the country, the rules of engagement needs to change. So even for the big businesses, for them to continue to maintain their businesses, the system needs to change. And I think that is what it will ultimately lead to the leveling of the playing field here.
Well, Babken, but let me challenge you here a little bit. If you talk to the Ukrainians or Georgians, many of them would tell you that their own revolutions were led by their love for their countries, their concern for it, their hatred of corruption, their very strong desire to see genuine democratic institutions being built in their countries. And I think some of them are disappointed right now. Again, what makes Armenia different from either Ukraine or Georgia?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that Armenia is not Ukraine or Georgia, and that our experience is unique to a certain extent. I think, for first of all, we're building on the success and the failures of past efforts to address the issues that you're talking about. So, in many ways, we have a leg up on anything that's been tried in the past. And I think time will tell how successful we'll be, but I'm very hopeful.
If I may follow up on that a little bit, I know you believe, as we all are, as we all do, that our countries are unique. And I know that in your previous academic experience, you had an opportunity of studying the experiences of many post-Soviet republics and that way to democratic or pseudo-democratic transitions, depending on your point of view. What are some of the experiences that you think deserve the attention in terms of emulating or, on the contrary, trying to avoid?
The special sauce in all of this comes down to political will. And I think what Nikol Pashinyan represents for many people is finally a leader that has the political will. Because quite frankly, a lot of the reforms that need to be done are not radical reforms. We don't need to reinvent the wheel here. Really, all it takes is some basic political will. And I think that's what Nikol Pashinyan represents. And that's what Nikol Pashinyan's government is going to enact.
Now, I know you've written an academic paper on the so-called anocracies, political regimes which adhere to some democratic practices, but while also sticking to the autocratic governance when it comes to their political and economic institutions. And I think there is a widespread belief in the West that once you take a corrupt or an autocratic leader out of power, then democracy sort of naturally blossoms. Is that what you expect to happen in Armenia?
No, because I don't think that democracy is necessarily a linear thing. I think what I tried to show in my paper is that this hybrid state of not quite autocracy and not quite democracy can actually be a stable form of government. But actually, in that same paper, the model that is presented shows that there are pathways to overcoming this hybrid regime. And that specifically happens at a point when civil society and political opposition joined forces. And actually, that's exactly what happened in Armenia.
I wonder if you expect this democratic transition to be fully grassroots, I mean, fully grown from within, or do you count on support from, let's say, the European Union and other Western countries in terms of strengthening and enabling and perhaps financing some of those changes?
Well, look, I think all countries have some sort of technical assistance that can always be helpful, but this is at its core a grassroots effort by the Armenian people for the Armenian people. So ultimately, whatever you see coming out of the Nikol Pashinyan administration is going to be based on Armenian values, Armenian tendencies, and Armenian people power.
Now, you said before that you don't really need to invent the wheel, and we all understand what's good for societies in political and economic terms. But I think, you know, the experience of my country, Russia, shows that the difficulty lies in not so much defining what needs to be done, but understanding how it could be done, how you can bring those new institutions and tailor them to your culture in a way to allow both to work in sync rather than sabotaging one another or subverting one another. I wonder if there is an understanding on your side in Nikol Pashinyan's team of where you should begin, what priorities should come first in order to turn this current euphoria into something more long-lasting, into something that will power those changes over the long haul.
With regards to how things need to be done, there's plenty of bright minds in Armenia that can figure that out and are figuring that out. But I think, like I mentioned previously, more importantly than how things should be done is whether or not they're done at all. And that comes straight from the political will. The reforms that the Nikol Pashinyan administration is going to be undertaking are going to be based on, as I mentioned, the principles of legitimacy, transparency, and justice. So whatever the immediate reforms are going to be ones that really just require some political will and are geared towards or focused towards increasing justice and increasing transparency, and are going to be founded on the legitimacy that the administration has on behalf of the people, which frankly no previous Armenian government has ever had.
I know that this idea of civil ownership, people saying that this is our country, it belongs to us, the power has to be accountable to us, has been very prominent during these protests and during other protests before. And it's easy to own victories. It's much more difficult to own disappointments or frustrations. How much time do you think the current leadership has to sustain this current enthusiasm, to, you know, keep this momentum running?
You know, I think the question is, it's the wrong question to ask, because it's really not a matter of time. As long as the people trust Nikol Pashinyan, the reforms, they are ready for the long haul. Everyone understands here with all the conversations I've had over the past few days, everyone understands that now is the time to roll up our sleeves and really get to the hard work. No one expects Armenia to change overnight, and really that's an unrealistic expectation. But people, the important thing is that the average Armenian needs to feel that tomorrow will be better than today. And really, that's not even about any concrete reforms. That's really a psychological state. And I think that's what this revolution has really brought within the Armenian people.
Well, the reason I'm asking this question is because for many of those changes to happen, you will also have to make sacrifices. For example, Armenia has a very huge foreign debt. And in order to manage it, you will have to cut the government spending. You will perhaps make other painful sacrifices. And I think, you know, human experience shows that people's resilience also has its limits. One of the reasons people took to the streets right now is because they want, first and foremost, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, economic change. They want to see economic development and democratic and political development as well. But from my understanding, their main motivations are of economic nature. And I think that has a certain expiration point, don't you think so?
You know, I have to disagree with you on that, but because actually, if you look at GDP per capita between if you compare Armenia and Georgia, for example, it's quite comparable. And in some cases, Armenia has a higher GDP per capita than Georgia. However, before this revolution, the feeling was not that tomorrow would be better today than today. Whereas in Georgia, my experience has often been that the average Georgian has often felt that tomorrow will be better than today. So really, it is about finally people believing in the fact that tomorrow will be better than today.
Well, we have to take a short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Babken Der Grigorian, international media liaison for Nikol Pashinyan's transition team. Babken, I know that you hold a master's degree in political communication, so let me ask you specifically about the political personality of Nikol Pashinyan. You said in one of your earlier interviews that initially you didn't like him much. I'm sure that has changed by now, but still, what were some of those things that initially made you skeptical about him?
Quite frankly, my issues with Nikol Pashinyan were less about Nikol Pashinyan and was more about his associations with the first president Levon Ter Petrosyan, with whom I have political disagreements with. But what Nikol Pashinyan has done is he's turned someone like me, a skeptic, into a true believer, because he has earned that respect. For years and years, I have seen him speak at parliament and say exactly the things that is on the minds of the average Armenian. He has, despite my best efforts, earned my respect, and has shown the kind of leadership that I think this country needs right now.
Now, Mr. Pashinyan's appearance also changed quite a bit in recent months. He is now compared to Che Guevara because of his beard and his predilection for military fatigues. But you can still find pictures on the internet of him being clean-shaven and wearing a nice suit. How much do you think that change in appearance contributed to the rise in his popularity? Does image matter at all, the visual projection of his persona?
I mean, let's be honest. Nikol Pashinyan is a PR genius. The way he has portrayed himself, not just as, you know, an MP who wears a suit, but as an actual leader of the people, is undeniable. So, yeah, of course it has an impact. However, I think it would be foolish to think that all of this was based on image, because really, more than image, it has to do with the contents of what he represents and what he stands for.
Now, one thing that viewers may not know about Armenia is that it is a country where chess lessons are compulsory for children, and chess skills are something we usually associate with politics and especially geopolitics. How good is Mr. Pashinyan at thinking through his moves and combinations? How shrewd is he as a political calculator?
Well, I'll answer that by referencing former President Serge Sarkisian, who many often used to label as a chess master. He was the president of the Chess Federation. And I think what Nikol Pashinyan showed was he checked and then checkmated the president of the Chess Federation, i.e. Serge Sarkisian. So I think that demonstrates his chess skills and his political skills.
But, I mean, let's be fair. It's only, it's not the beginning for him. He has a very long and sometimes painful career. Mr. Pashinyan, after all, has been jailed for his political activism before. But when it comes to governance, it's only the beginning. Do you think keeping power and making a meaningful change will be just as easy as taking it?
Well, look, I think Nikol Pashinyan demonstrates certain attributes that are very rare in Armenia and the post-Soviet world, which is the ability to self-reflect, to learn from his own past mistakes and successes, and also to critically listen to the people around him. I've been really impressed by his ability to listen carefully to his core team and to really be able to pick and choose the things that make the most sense. And I think the success of this movement is really based on that, is his ability to really seek out the brightest minds and to know that sometimes he's not the one that has the right answer. It's the guy that's sitting next to him.
Now, this revolution, and I know that you don't like calling it a revolution.
I do like calling it a revolution. And actually, well, I was very hesitant to call it a revolution until the police released a statement, and the police labeled it a revolution. And once the police labels it a revolution, at that point, it's a revolution.
Well, and that revolution has a symbol, the one that you're wearing right now. I wonder what's written on that cap. Is it Make Armenia Great Again?
I think it's just a way for people to visibly signal to everyone else around them that they are in the spirit of the revolution, and really nothing more than that.
I was intending to ask you before about the Armenia-centric nature of this movement, which has been really different from all the other transitions, power transitions that we've observed in the post-Soviet space so far. Its lack of geopolitical component, geopolitical competition has been really striking. And some say it played a major role in ensuring that this power transition would be as peaceful as it has been without a single bullet shot. How do you explain that? Why was Armenia spared the foreign meddling that more often than not accompanies a change of power in countries of strategic geographical importance?
Well, I think you're right that this was a unique attribute of the Armenian Revolution. I guess I would say that the lack of geopolitics was a strategic move, because once you remove geopolitics from the equation, then you can really start to address the domestic real issues that people care about on a daily basis. Geopolitics in this sense, I mean, it's no secret that Armenia is in a very geopolitically precarious environment overall. So bringing that into the revolution, honestly, would have just complicated it and would probably lead to its failure. So it was a strategic decision as much as a moral and value-based one.
Now, Mr. Pashinyan promised earlier on that if elected, he would not change Yerevan's relationship with Moscow or the West. But what about your Muslim neighbors, both to the east and to the west? I mean, Turkey and Azerbaijan. Do you foresee any changes there?
I think as in Armenia's foreign policies are structural, and they are less about who's in power and more about the geopolitical nature that Armenia finds itself. So with regards to our neighbors, with regards to our strategic partnership with Russia, with regards to our working relationship with Europe, you will not find very much deviation from the past.
Well, the reason I'm asking this question is because before Mr. Pashinyan was voted in by parliament, he suggested that he would push for recognition of the sovereignty of Nagorno-Karabakh region, which is one of Armenia's most difficult and long-running problems. And I know that he's about to visit that region, I believe, on Wednesday. You're supposed to accompany him on that trip. What is the logic of disturbing this frozen conflict before addressing all the domestic challenges that you mentioned before?
I don't see what he's doing as disturbing the logic. And I think you'll notice that even during this whole revolution, there really wasn't an issue regarding Nagorno-Karabakh. His stance on Nagorno-Karabakh has been very clear. And is going to continue along the same lines as previous administrations have. But the important thing here is that unlike previous administrations, Nikol Pashinyan is actually going to have the legitimacy to speak on behalf of the Armenian people. And I believe that that will allow for an environment that leads to a peaceful resolution much more quickly. And quite frankly, it'd be great to see a government in Azerbaijan that could also speak on behalf of the people, because that's the only way to really come to a peaceful resolution on this conflict.
But Mr. Grigorian, I'm sure you know that Azerbaijan is not going to take his visit to that region lightly. There is also Turkey, which already said that it's going to support Baku till the very end, whatever it means. Now, there is Russia, which is treaty-bound to intervene or support Armenia in the event of a conflict. So my point is that the escalatory potential here is pretty unsettling. I just wonder why involving the issue of Nagorno-Karabakh is...
I have to disagree with you on the basis that what Nikol Pashinyan is doing by visiting Nagorno-Karabakh is nothing more than what every other Armenian president and prime minister has done in the past. There is nothing extraordinary there. It's standard operating procedure for all Armenian presidents and prime ministers in the past, and it's I don't foresee it causing any greater headache.
Well, it's interesting you believe that, because Mr. Pashinyan specifically said during his speech to parliament that this revolution will lead to the de jure recognition of the right of Karabakh to self-determination. And we are talking here about a change of borders, because Nagorno-Karabakh formally still lies within the internationally recognized borders of Azerbaijan, even though it has been under the control of the ethnic Armenian forces for more than 20 years. Recognizing Nagorno-Karabakh is a major issue. That would be a major game changer in the region.
Yeah, so Nikol Pashinyan spoke about the right for self-determination for the people of Nagorno-Karabakh. Again, this is a standard. This is not a deviation from anything in the past. Every Armenian government has spoken about the right of self-determination for the people of Nagorno-Karabakh. And again, I don't see anything extraordinary in his rhetoric there. Really, I don't.
Let me just clarify. Do you think if Armenia was indeed to maintain this stance on recognizing the right of self-determination of the Nagorno-Karabakh region, is it likely to do that unilaterally, or is it likely to try to seek some regional and international support for that?
Armenia has always and continues to maintain that the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict needs to be resolved within the framework of the OSCE Minsk Group. And one of the principles of the OSCE Minsk Group is the right for self-determination. So again, like I said, there's really nothing there.
Bob, can we have time for just one question? And it may come across as lame to you, but please indulge me. We've discussed the recent changes in Pashinyan's appearance, his recent efforts to look more like a military man, despite him never having taken part in any active combat. And some of the observers suggested that he deliberately tries to look like the Armenian hero from those early clashes in Nagorno-Karabakh, Monte Melkonyan. They look like identical twins at this point, even, you know, with the bandage on the same hand. Is that just a coincidence, or is that also a clever use of political technology? Because some would accuse him of trying to appeal to that militaristic or nationalistic feeling on the part of many Armenians. Many Armenians do feel entitled to Nagorno-Karabakh. So the idea here, the suggestion here, that he's trying to invoke some of that with his image.
I think the observers that suggest that are absolutely wrong. I mean, the reason why he has a bandage on that hand, or had a bandage on that hand, is because it was cut by barbed wire. I think more than anything, the political technology you want to be looking for there is the contrast between his military appearance and the peaceful nature of the protests. I think that's the image that most stands out. Any visual appearance or similarities to Monte Melkonyan, I mean, half of Armenian men with a beard could pass for Monte Melkonyan these days. So I think those observers are just wrong and uninformed.
Well, Babken, thank you very much for being with us today. We have to leave it there. I really hope, and many of us here in Russia hope, that Armenia will make us both jealous and proud of its achievements. We are looking forward to the transition, and good luck with the reform agenda.
Thank you very much.
Well, and our viewers can keep this conversation going on our social media pages. As for me, hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.